The headlines. A local Canadian tribe announces that it has found more than 160 undocumented and unmarked graves near a residential school site. China says it opposes the U.S. interfering in its internal affairs related to Hong Kong. And Tigrayan rebel forces in the conflict-torn northern region of Ethiopia launch a new offensive and seize a major town. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us. Canadian Indigenous community says that it has found more than 160 undocumented and unmarked graves in an area home to a former Catholic residential school for Native children. The Penutlakut tribe said that the graves were found in southern Gulf Islands in the state of British Columbia. The grounds were home to Cooper School. The facility was part of a national plan that forced Indigenous families to send their children to Catholic boarding schools to be supposedly civilized. A series of unmarked mass graves containing remains of Indigenous kids have been found in Canada in the past several weeks. One contained the bodies of more than 750 children. The discoveries have sparked outrage among the First Nation communities. They have called the practice cultural genocide. China says it opposes the U.S. interference in its internal affairs over issues related to Hong Kong. Beijing reacted after a report said that Washington is set to warn U.S. companies of increasing risks of operating in Hong Kong. The Chinese Foreign Ministry said that Hong Kong's basic and relevant laws protect the interests of foreign investors. Beijing and Washington are at odds over a range of issues for months now. Those issues include China's policies on Hong Kong and Taiwan, as well as trade and the COVID-19 pandemic. Chinese Navy forces drive away a U.S. warship after it entered the country's waters, calling on Washington to stop quotas provocative actions. The incident comes amid simmering tensions between the two sides in the region.
There seems to be no end at sight to tensions between the United States and China. In the latest development, China's military announced it drove away a U.S. warship that it said illegally entered Chinese waters near the disputed Paracel Island. It also urged Washington to stop such provocative actions. In reaction, the U.S. Navy claimed that the USS Benfold asserted navigational rights and freedoms in the vicinity of the Paracel Islands. It also dismissed China's claim of a serious violation of its sovereignty as false and a misrepresentation. The U.S. move coincided with the fifth anniversary of an international arbitral ruling that favored the Philippines and invalidated China's maritime claims in the South China Sea. Beijing has consistently dismissed the tribunal's finding. Regarding the occasion, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called on Beijing to stop what he called aggressive acts in the South China Sea. Blinken said that freedom of the seas was an enduring interest of all nations.
Nowhere is the rules-based maritime order under greater threat than in the South China Sea. The People's Republic of China continues to coerce and intimidate Southeast Asian coastal states, threatening freedom of navigation in this critical global thruway.
The South China Sea has become a major bone of contention between Beijing and Washington over the past years. The U.S. routinely sends warships and warplanes to the region to assert what it calls its right to freedom of navigation, ratcheting up tensions among the countries in the region. China has constantly warned the U.S. over its military activities in the contested waters. Beijing and Washington are also at odds over a range of issues, including China's policies with regard to Hong Kong and Taiwan, as well as their trade policies and origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Amid strained relations between the two sides, there have been fears that the South China Sea could emerge as a potential flashpoint. China had hoped for an improvement in relations under U.S. President Joe Biden, who succeeded Donald Trump in January. But a new administration has shown no sign of backing down on Trump's hardline policies toward China.
Several of the men involved in the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse were previously U.S. law enforcement informants. That is what CNN has reported. American TV has spoken with people briefed on the matter. At least one of the arrested suspects was a confidential source to the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. That's what it told CNN. Other suspects also had U.S. ties, including working as informants for the FBI. The Haitian president was shot dead at his private home near the Capitol last Wednesday. 28 people, including three Americans, were involved. On Monday, Haitian police said that they had caught the mastermind behind the assassination. They said the suspect had used the Florida-based security firm to hire mercenaries to kill Moïse. John Stepling is an author and commentator. He says former U.S. President Bill Clinton and his wife Hillary, as a former Secretary of State, are responsible for the current situation in Haiti.
The Clintons are responsible for the current situation almost directly. Bill and Hillary went to Haiti on their honeymoon, as it happened, and since then, I think they have viewed it as their private plantation. The previous president before Moise was Michael Martelly, who, as a 15-year-old, had joined the Tonton Macoute death squads. This was well known. He was also a calypso singer. I guess these are the qualifications for presidency in the eyes of Hillary Clinton, because she very directly handpicked him and made sure he was elected in a completely fraudulent election. But the Clintons are responsible by proxy, meaning Martelly, for unleashing the FRAPH gang rape and murder rampage after the coup in 91. Martelly's record is just horrendous, and his handpicked successor was Moise, and his background is equally checkered and equally steeped in the Duvalierist ethos.
The Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro says 10 Colombian paramilitaries have died in violent clashes with security forces in the capital, Caracas. Maduro said that a number of other paramilitaries had fled, adding that search is underway to find them. He said the Colombian paramilitaries have been training what he called criminals and terrorists in Venezuela for months. Caracas blames those criminals for a recent wave of unrest that has taken a toll on civilians. This past Saturday, more than 24 people were killed in clashes between Venezuelan security forces and gangs in Caracas. Bogota says the gangs are linked to its now disbanded Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, known as FARC. Fighters aligned with local leaders in Ethiopia's Tigray say that they have launched a new offensive in the northern region and seized a major town there. The spokesman for the Tigray fighters said that they had managed to clear the town of Raya from the federal forces. He also said the fighters have seized control of the southern parts of Tigray. Clashes are also underway in the western parts of the region. Tigray has witnessed deadly fighting between Ethiopian federal troops and local fighters since November. Thousands of people have been killed and hundreds of thousands displaced ever since. The Taliban militant group says it does not want to engage in fighting inside Afghan cities. The Taliban made the announcement as it continues fighting with government forces in different areas of the country. The group also gave a warning to Turkey over its decision to extend troop presence after U.S. led forces fully leave next month. On Friday, Ankara announced that it had reached a conditional deal with Washington to continue guarding Afghanistan's international airport in Kabul. The Taliban called the decision ill-advised, reprehensible, and a violation of Afghanistan's territory. A couple of days after the U.S. forces' withdrawal from their biggest military base in Afghanistan, our correspondent in the war-torn country, Amin Alami, paid a visit to the airbase to see the situation closely. Here is more in this report.
This is Kabul-Bagram Highway, and we are on our way to Bagram District in northern Parwan province to visit Bagram Airfield. The 70 hectares airfield was known as the symbol of the U.S. military power in Afghanistan before its withdrawal from this key site. Now, Bagram Military Air Base, which was known as an American town in Afghanistan, is handed over to Afghan National Army, and the government says having control over Bagram helps Afghan forces to effectively manage and launch counter-terrorism operations against terrorist groups, mainly the Taliban. But as this army general says, the government needs more time to either collect all remaining tools, vehicles and other facilities or deploy military forces in Bagram.
Our working group are continuing their work inside the Bagram. We don't want to lose the facilities which left by the American forces here. We are assured that we try to use all the facilities. In the future, some of the maybe Air Force branch will deploy here, but the priority is right now to secure the area.
Press TV team got permission to see some insider parts of the airfield. The first destination is parking lot, where the U.S. forces left their military vehicles. Then we visited the Bagram Hospital. Officials say they are working to make it operational very soon.
The Health Affairs Department of the Ministry of Defense has planned to make this hospital in Bagram operational. That is why we are here working on the plan despite some problems like shortage of power and some administrative issues.
One of the other places to visit is the residential area, but when we were heading to this site, we faced many hideouts being used to protect U.S. forces from possible Taliban rocket attacks. However, it seems U.S. forces have even left their boots behind due to a hurry to leave this largest military base in Afghanistan. Bagram Military Airfield was considered as one of the strategic bases across Afghanistan, not only during the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, but even earlier during the Soviet Union occupation of the country. Now, the Afghan government should decide how to protect this vast base and deploy Afghan forces here. Sayed Amin Alami, Bagram Air Base in northern Parwan province.
Iran says its position on Vienna talks aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal has not changed since the beginning of the negotiations, adding that certain issues are still unresolved. The foreign ministry spokesman said that a long way has been taken to tackle the issues, but the remaining path is not smooth. Saeed Khatibzadeh noted that Tehran's demands during the talks have been very clear. The U.S. must first remove all sanctions in a verifiable manner. He stressed that Tehran regards any extra demands beyond the original deal as irrelevant. Meanwhile, Washington said that it is ready for a new round of talks. The U.S. does not participate directly in the negotiations, which have been held six times since April. A former British Parliament speaker has become the latest European politician to support an armed terrorist organization that's bent on overthrowing the Iranian government. John Berko, who joined the MEK's annual gathering in Albania virtually, has been criticized for associating with a terrorist cult behind assassinations and bombings that have resulted in the deaths of thousands of Iranians over the past four decades. Said Purza reports.
Yet another attempt by a banned terrorist organization at rebranding itself as a legitimate opposition group in exile. The Mujahideen Khal organization, known as the MKO, which held its annual gathering in Albania, featuring generously paid politicians and former government officials from the U.S. and Europe, giving carefully worded speeches in person or online. Among them, former British Parliament Speaker John Bercow, the man who recently defected the Conservative Party for Labour after launching a withering attack on his erstwhile party member, Prime Minister Boris Johnson. We reached out to Mr. Bercow's media representative requesting for clarification regarding his involvement with the MEK. Received an automated response saying they would be in touch shortly. We are yet to hear from them.
I think our politicians need to be careful about how they behave, and that's politicians of all colours. And I think, unfortunately, they're really stretching the bounds of ethics and what it is to be a public servant, which is very unfortunate.
Former politicians speaking at the MEK's annual gatherings is not without precedent. Over the years, the terror cult has splashed out sizable sums of money to enlist the support of people in power on both sides of the Atlantic. Most notably, former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton paid upwards of $40,000 per speech in 2018.
Only three reasons can explain why the former Speaker of the British House of Commons might speak to the MKO. Either he literally doesn't know of the thousands and thousands of people this terrorist organization has killed, or he doesn't care about that, or the money was so tempting that it became more important than any moral objection to the MKO.
The MKO, who used to be based in a large military garrison in Iraq, fought against Iran alongside Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s and provided material and intelligence support in a conflict that lasted eight long years and left hundreds of thousands dead, injured, or displaced on either side. In 2000, they were designated as a terrorist organization. 12 years later, the U.S. government removed them from a list of terrorist organizations, and in 2013, the terrorist group relocated to a vast and tightly guarded barracks in Albania that few outsiders have ever entered.
Experts say to see former American and European officials support a known terrorist organization in return for money speaks to the double standard exercised by those individuals when it comes to the issue of terrorism. Saeed Purizap, London.
Palestinians have staged a demonstration outside of an Israeli prison near the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah, calling for an immediate release of a detainee to attend her daughter's funeral. The protesters chanted slogans in solidarity with Khalida Sharar, a Palestinian lawmaker serving a prison sentence at Ofer Prison. Palestinian rights organization Al-Haq has sent an urgent appeal to the UN calling for her release. Palestinian activists and rights groups have also put up an online petition, but the regime has so far denied the request. Sharar was given a 2-year sentence on alleged charges of inciting violence and belonging to a banned organization. Her 31-year-old daughter was found dead at her home on Sunday from an apparent heart attack. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah has released new footage showing the capture of two Israeli soldiers back in the year 2006. The video shows Hezbollah troops firing at an Israeli vehicle carrying the two soldiers in order to stop it. They then arrest the soldiers and leave the scene. The footage was aired by a Lebanese channel owned and operated by Hezbollah. The release marks the anniversary of the incident which sparked the Second Lebanon War in 2006. 2 years later, Hezbollah returned the bodies of both Israeli soldiers as part of a deal with Tel Aviv. Israel claims that they were killed at the moment of their capture, but Lebanon says they lost their lives later in Israeli bombardments. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
June 28, 2021, on the occasion of the National Judiciary Week and the martyrdom anniversary of Ayatollah Martyr Beheshti and other personalities. The jihadi movement in the judiciary branch, initiated by Hujjatul Islam Raisi, has earned the people's trust. Well, it is necessary to thank Mr. Raisi as the judiciary branch is undergoing a transformation. During the 2+ years that he was in charge of the judiciary, he really worked hard and good things were done in that branch. And Mr. Raisi's move in the judiciary was an example of what we always repeat, jihadi movement. Jihadi movement means a serious, round-the-clock, hard-working and motivated movement. The movement launched by him was like this, and thankfully, it has had good results. The most important effect of this movement was that it revived the people's hope for the judiciary, and it made the people optimistic about the judiciary. We receive people's complaints from various organizations. There is a lot of difference in the people's opinion before and after these 2+ years. His services revived hope and confidence in the branch. This is social capital. The people's trust in the active apparatus in the Islamic Republic is a great social capital, and there is nothing equivalent to it. Thankfully, the judiciary branch has accomplished this feat. The necessity to continue the transformation movement in the judiciary branch. Well, now that the judiciary is undergoing a new change, I have to make a few points that, God willing, will be taken into consideration in the future of the judiciary movement. These are exactly the things he just said, and I have written them down as well. First, there is the issue of the transformational approach in the judiciary branch. Of course, transformation in the true sense of the word does not happen in a year or two, but the beginning of this movement in the judiciary and the adoption of this orientation and this approach was very important. It must continue. It must not stop. Rather, it must intensify. Naturally, if we start a movement and if we want it to produce the desired results, then not only should the movement not see a hiatus in the middle of the way, but it should also intensify and be strengthened so that it can reach the final destination. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Haiti's President Jovenel Moïse was killed during an attack on his private residence in the capital of Port-au-Prince on early Wednesday. Haiti's First Lady was also wounded in the attack and evacuated to a hospital in Miami for treatment. She later accused enemies of sending mercenaries to kill the president and his family to thwart democratic changes in the country. That's why none of the Moïse's guards were injured in the attack. Moreover, Haitian officials have not yet provided a motive for the assassination or explained how the killers got past Moïse's security detail. Haitian police says they have identified 28 people in connection to the fatal shooting, of which 2 were U.S. citizens. The rest, all Colombian, remain at large. The Colombian Defense Ministry says initial findings suggest that several of the attackers have been retired members of the Colombian military. Colombian police have confirmed that four companies were involved in the assassination of the Haitian president. The companies recruited Colombian nationals who traveled to Haiti through the neighboring Dominican Republic. On the other hand, when pressed on reports that two Haitian Americans were involved with the assassination, the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki declined to comment. This arouses suspicions about possible U.S. involvement. After all, the U.S. has a track record when it comes to these types of operations. In 2020, two U.S. citizens were arrested in Venezuela. The Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, accused Washington of plotting to invade his country, overthrow, and assassinate him. Maduro claimed that the invaders were trained and funded by the U.S. and Colombia. Also, there was the infamous Bay of Pigs operation. 50 years ago, a group of some 1,500 Cuban exiles, trained and financed by the CIA, launched an ill-fated invasion of Cuba from the sea in the Bay of Pigs. The plan was to overthrow Fidel Castro and his revolution. Furthermore, the U.S. track record in Haiti speaks volumes in how the U.S. has treated the country. A simple history check reveals the deep U.S. involvement in this tiny island nation. In 1914, the U.S. sent Marines into Haiti. It gained complete control over Haitian finances and the right to intervene in Haiti whenever the U.S. government deemed necessary at the time. The U.S. government also forced the election of a new pro-American president by the Haitian legislature in August 1915. The selection of a president that did not represent the choice of the Haitian populace increased unrest in Haiti. Meanwhile, Haiti has been struggling with a wave of extreme violence, a growing humanitarian crisis, and a worsening coronavirus pandemic, and now the assassination of Moïse has thrown the country into deeper turmoil, as his death leaves a power vacuum.
However, we do know for sure the United States that this solves a lot of problems for the United States regarding its interest in Haiti and their support for Jovenel Moïse and that administration. It was an untenable situation. They had already been supporting him through a very suspect abolishing of the Constitution. He extended his term. Now he was ruling by decree, and they were about to force on the Haitian people another election and a new constitution under very, you know, circumstances in which the Haitian people didn't want. Clearly the masses of Haitian people were in the street.
Haitian President Jovenel Moïse's death has led to confusion about who is the legitimate person to lead the country of 11 million people. Claude Joseph, who had resigned as prime minister, took charge of the government and named himself acting president in the hours after the assassination. Ariel Henry, whom Moïse had named prime minister but had not yet taken office, also claims he should be in charge. Furthermore, Joseph Lambert, who leads what remains of the Haitian Senate, joined two others seeking to rule the nation, announced that he was voted provisional president by his fellow senators Friday evening. With tensions high in the capital, crowds of people took to the streets Thursday night, burning cars and demanding justice. Meanwhile, the COVID-19 pandemic has been worsening in Haiti. According to the United Nations Children's Agency, Haiti was the only country in the Western Hemisphere to not have received a single dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. At the same time, according to the World Bank, the country is facing a dire economic situation. Its economy had shrunk further 3.8% in 2020, with about 60% of the population now living in poverty. Furthermore, according to UNICEF, more than 1.5 million children are currently in urgent need of humanitarian assistance in Haiti.
The United States is directly responsible for the situation, decidedly so. It's an intentional to keep Haiti underdeveloped, to keep control of its resources and its labor and its markets under the control of foreign corporations.
With Haiti having a track record of interference from Western governments like the U.S. and France, it remains to be seen whether the country will be able to preserve any peace and stability as it goes through this transformation. Moïse's murder has prompted the government to call for U.S. and UN assistance. At this point, the U.S. has said it will only take necessary action to defend Americans and critical infrastructure.
Gun violence is killing more people in the U.S. state of New York than the COVID-19 pandemic. That's according to New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. He announced on Thursday that he has declared gun violence in New York a disaster emergency, making extra funding and resources available to combat shootings statewide. The first of its kind executive order came at a time when New York City and the country as a whole are struggling to curtail the spike in gun violence. Speaking during an event at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, Cuomo said his plan includes short-term and long-term measures that treat gun violence as a public health crisis. Cuomo said nearly $139 million will be invested in prevention and employment programs to help youth and keep at-risk young people off the streets.
Fact, gun violence discriminates. The way COVID discriminated, gun violence discriminates. When you look among the victims of gun violence nationally, 59% non-white. New York State, 68% non-white. New York City, 77% non-white. Think about that, 77%.
Well, these poor Black and Latino neighborhoods and people are likely to be victims because crime is rampant in these communities. But why is crime rampant in these communities? Well, as we see and we know, poverty exacerbates not only just gun violence, but all sorts of violence, petty theft, nonviolent crimes, drugs, gang violence. And these poor Black and Latino neighborhoods have been neglected by the government, by New York State, as well as their neighborhoods have been sold out. Gentrification throughout New York City is specifically targeting neighborhoods in Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx.
Cuomo also announced he was going to sign legislation that allows for civil lawsuits against gun manufacturers, distributors, and dealers for how they market and sell firearms. The governor added that over the 4th of July weekend, at least 51 people fell victim to gun violence across the U.S. state alone. U.S. President Joe Biden announced last month his plan to fight the rising gun crimes across the country.
Today, the department is announcing, as I just did, a major crackdown on stem the flow of guns used to commit violent crimes. It's zero tolerance for gun dealers who willfully violate key existing laws and regulations. Let me repeat, zero tolerance.
His plan includes allocating more funds to law enforcement agencies to improve their ability to track and disrupt gun trafficking. He's set to meet with the country's law enforcement, local elected officials, and advocates to discuss the plan on Monday. The White House says the $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package provides funding not only to the police, but also to programs such as youth employment, which can help reduce crime rates. The Democrats and Republicans are now pointing fingers at each other over soaring gun violence, with the GOPs criticizing Biden's performance in fighting crimes and Democrats blaming their political rivals for blocking their proposals on gun control.
The American obsession with guns at its root is because our founding fathers and the right have just made it part of the American identity, make it seem as if to be American is to own a gun, when being American is so much more than that. It's about working hard and defending your neighbor and, you know, wanting better for yourselves.
An FBI report in March pointed to a 25% increase in the number of homicide cases in 2020 compared to a year before. Figures suggest the rising trend has continued into 2021, fueling concerns that the U.S. could witness one of its highest numbers of homicides it has ever recorded this year.
Lebanon is just days away from a social explosion. The stark warning has been made by Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab, who has called on the international community to help the country avoid an all-out economic and social crisis. According to the World Bank, Lebanon is now experiencing one of the worst economic depressions in modern history. Diab has been serving in a caretaker capacity since resigning in the wake of the catastrophic August 4 Beirut port explosion. More than 200 people were killed and over 6,000 others injured in the giant blast. Dozens of people are still unaccounted for. Since then, politicians have been unable to agree on a new government. I appeal through you to the kings, princes, presidents and leaders of brotherly and friendly countries. And I call upon the United Nations and all international bodies, the international community, and the global public opinion to help save the Lebanese from death and prevent the demise of Lebanon. Diab has urged friendly nations to help Lebanon despite the lack of a new government. He said only a new cabinet could restart talks with the International Monetary Fund so that the country may get out of its deepening crisis.
Linking aid to Lebanon with government formation has started to threaten the lives of people and to the Lebanese entity because the pressures that are being exercised and the siege imposed on Lebanon do not affect the corrupt. Instead, it is the Lebanese people who pay the heavy price that threatens their lives and their future.
Amid the political standoff, occasional unrest marked by attacks on government buildings, and the torching of banks and financial institutions by certain elements has sparked warnings of what's to come. Lebanon is now on the brink of total collapse. Anger over fuel shortages has spilled into fights at petrol stations since the country is short of fuel. The national currency has now lost more than 90% of its value since October 2019. The country's gross domestic product dropped from close to $55 billion in 2018 to an estimated $33 billion last year. GDP per capita also plummeted by around 40%. The nation's unemployment rate spiked from 28% in February 2020 to nearly 40% by the end of the year.
It's because the whole economic crisis is manufactured. The central bank manager is controlled by the United States, and all the banks have also loyalty to the United States. And so over the last 2.5 years, these banks moved out close to $60 billion out of the country, which crashed the lira. And now all that money is in Switzerland. Nobody's being held responsible.
The crisis has worsened with the central bank cutting back on financing imports with subsidized dollars. The crisis is mostly linked to the sanctions that the U.S. and its allies have imposed on Lebanon, as well as foreign intervention in the Arab nation's domestic affairs.
While the United States has been trying for more than 15 years, and even more than that, to corner Hezbollah in Lebanon and get the population to rise up against it. It didn't work in 2006 in the war directly with apartheid Israel.
Over 250 of Washington's sanctions targets are in Lebanon or related to the country, and this number has been growing quickly. U.S. sanctions have seriously undermined the stability of the banking sector by reducing the inflow of foreign capital.
So the purposeful crashing of the economy and making life harder for Lebanese people, the United States is hoping that the population in Lebanon would rise up against Hezbollah. And as we've heard from Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah will try its best to make sure that this plan doesn't work.
Saudi Arabia has also imposed its own sanctions, including banning its citizens from traveling to Lebanon, where Riyadh-backed elements have been jockeying for position.
Iran has been a major victim of terrorism over the past decades, with over 17,000 Iranians losing their lives in terrorist attacks. Iran has long criticized Western states, especially the United States, for employing double standards in dealing with terrorism. The West's support for anti-Iran terrorist group Mujahideen-e Khalq organization, also known as the MKO, is a case in point. The notorious Mujahideen-e Khalq organization is responsible for the killing of about 12,000 Iranian people and officials since the Islamic Revolution of 1979. The group has carried out bombings and assassinations across Iran. The MKO is a well-known enemy of the Iranian nation with a horrific record that is known to all countries in the region and beyond. During the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s, the MKO joined forces with former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein to carry out cross-border attacks.
They also helped the former Iraqi dictator to crack down on dissent at home. After the war, MKO members spent many years in a camp in Iraq's Diyala province before being relocated to Albania in 2016. The cult-like group does not tolerate any form of dissent within the organization. Former MKO members who managed to leave the group have painted a grim picture of how the organization treats its members, especially those who intend to leave the MKO. They have reported abuses ranging from solitary confinements to severe beatings and torture. Over the past years, MKO summits have been attended by hawkish U.S. politicians such as former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, and former Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich. The U.S. politicians are said to have received hefty sums to attend MKO summits and back the group's calls for regime change in Iran. Observers believe the American and European stances regarding the MKO have exposed their double standards in dealing with terrorism.
When they say that they want to fight terrorist organizations, what they mean is they want to fight every sort of organization that is in any way an obstacle in the further benefit of Western hegemony. We have seen the term terrorism being used over and over and over again to assign any and every sort of organization, even the ones that are not even violent, any sort of organization that opposes imperialism.
The Mujahideen Khalq organization was on the U.S. list of terrorist groups for 15 years, but then removed in 2012 to pave the way for the MKO to receive funds more easily. Iran says lobbies in the United States were heavily bribed that year to facilitate the controversial removal. Major European countries, including France, also removed it from their blacklists. Top MKO members, including its public face, Maryam Rajavi, have been moving closer to hawkish U.S. politicians. The deepening ties between U.S. and European governments and Mujahideen Khalq terror group suggests that the West may be trying to use the MKO to pressure Iran.
It is not surprising, unfortunately, to see such a close collusion between the MKO and the United States of America. We have seen this happen for the past 30, 40 years. And this has become very clear a couple of years ago, of course, when they held a massive rally in which they invited people such as John Bolton and Rudy Giuliani, some of the most imperialist war hawks that the United States has ever known in the past, let's say, century. So when they attend meetings of the MKO and when they speak there of what they consider the need for, quote-unquote, spreading democracy to Iran, this is what they are trying to achieve. The resurgence of U.S. imperialist control.
How can Western states be supporting this notorious terrorist group and at the same time accuse other countries of backing terrorism?
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and He's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome to another program of Islamic Upbringing at IRIB English Radio. We'll be discussing some of the questions that you've sent us about Islamic upbringing. In the program, we mostly do refer to the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shehri. Today, we have Brother Miqdad with us, and we welcome Brother Miqdad to another program. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
In our last program, we had a question. I'll read out the question so our listeners catch on to us, and we can go on from there. It said, how do you increase self-confidence in a child? I fear that sometimes my child is not taking steps to take up new tasks or projects, and this might be because he does not believe that he might be successful in something. In other words, I think fear of failure. So, you did elaborate quite a lot about this, but if you've got anything else that we could add to it, we could go on from there.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we were talking about self-confidence, and in the previous shows, we talked about the signs of confidence, and we said what is self-confidence, and how can we actually see in a child within adults what actually would be counted as a lack of confidence or having confidence. And these are signs that are very important, and we need to all work on those signs and really find out and know our children better and understand what does it mean, confidence. These are things that we talked about in the previous show. And then we started talking about how to increase the self-confidence and what things parents can do to really bring out the best in their children. We talked about a show of respect, and we said how important it is for parents to show respect to their children. And we talked about all the verses and the tradition that talk about the ikram of a child, and how Islam places a huge amount of importance on showing value to a child, showing that a child is important, making a child feel that they have an important position in the heart of their parents, an important position in the house, etc. This ikram, this honor and value that you give to somebody is very important. Actually,
so when you say you give value to somebody, does it mean the individual itself, or does it also include their opinions, be it that they're at a younger age?
Definitely. So inclusive of all this, so we'll talk about this as well. So the second point that we had mentioned last time was allowing them to take decisions, allowing them to express their views and their opinions and their thoughts, and giving value to that, right? This is not to say that we don't count something as good or bad, or we accept everything, or we give complete approval to everything that the child would say. Obviously, it has to be based on a level of truth, a level of wisdom. But this is not to say that we humiliate or we completely reject just because a child has said something.
Even if they're wrong, you have to phrase it in a manner that they do not feel debased in a manner.
Exactly. So it's very important. We realize that from the hadith that we have, that the Ahlul Bayt would deal with their children in such a way. They would give a lot of importance to children, importance to their thoughts, their opinions. They would listen to children. They would allow them to talk. They would allow them to say things, even though they would be in a gathering of adults, for example. And these things really play a role in strengthening this idea that a child is actually valuable, is actually important.
I'm cutting you off on and on, but if it's okay with you, Brother Miqdad, we're going to go for a break, and then we're going to come back and join you over again. Dear listeners, please stay tuned, and we're going to carry on with our discussion after this short break.
IRIB English Radio presents. A priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5 years old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio at irib.ir.
Welcome back. We're talking about Islamic upbringing, and we're at IRIB English Radio. Brother Miqdad, these questions that come to my mind. The Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salatu wasalam, is it not true that their children were quite different to our children? And me as a parent, I might be afraid of being embarrassed in the community when my child might not say something that might say something that's not supposed to be said.
The children of the Ahlul Bayt were not different from our children. Yes. We have the infallible children, but having said that, even with them, the kind of relationship and the kind of apparent actions that the Ahlul Bayt would do with them is very similar, because they're role models, right? So they would do things based on what's apparent and what's normal, basically. We're not talking about supernatural human beings, right? We're talking about normal human beings that would live a normal life, and the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt would deal with these children in a very normal way, as if their normal children. And you see that their dealing with children is not just related to or limited to their infallible children, but they had other children as well, and also how they dealt with other people's children as well. Mm-hmm. So you have stories about how they would deal with children playing on the streets, for example. They would deal with children playing in the mosque, for example. They would deal with children that they would find when other people would come to them, for example, with their children. So they would deal with other children other than them, their own children. And you find that they dealt with all of these children in a very specific and very respectful way. A couple of examples. One of them, I think these have been mentioned quite a few times, but it's always worth going back to them, because they really show and have a lot to say, basically, to us. So, for example, hadith number 207, we find that once Imam Hassan alayhi salam, he gathers his children and his brother's children, and he says that, "O my children and my brother's children, you are the little young people of this generation, and there is hope that you will be the great ones of another generation." Giving a lot of hope for these children, that today you're very small, today you're playing, but I want to tell you that you are very important. I see you as the future of the next generation, and that you're going to be the hope of the greatness of the next generation, basically. And this is very important, that when we look at our children, we should see our children like this, that our children are going to be
the leaders of tomorrow.
Exactly, the leaders of tomorrow. They're going to be those who are going to be important, valuable members of the society of tomorrow, where we won't be there. And when we perceive this, when we have this within us, and children see that from us as parents, they see that really we count them as valuable and important. They build this sense of confidence. They really start to believe that they are valuable and very important. This is what leads to having confidence.
Sorry to interrupt you there, Brother Miqdad. If it's okay, we go for another break and we return and continue from where we leave. Please stay tuned, dear listeners, and we'll be back right after a short break.
يا مطي الخيرات يا مطي الخيرات
إمام السجاد عليه السلام said, "A child's right is to be kind to him when educating him, forgiving him, covering his mistakes, acting moderately towards him and helping him.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We're back with Islamic upbringing, and we're talking about confidence in a child. So a sense of responsibility is different to confidence in general, and this, what you're talking about, basically provides them with both, a sense of responsibility and confidence.
So sense of responsibility is a good point. Sense of responsibility is basically what's going to give them confidence as well. So over here, we're talking mainly about a sense of importance, basically. Now, the next point in building self-confidence is giving responsibilities. For example, responsibility related to house chores or responsibility related to things that are related to outside of the house, taking care of somebody, taking care of the siblings, for example, buying
so
things
this
from
this
the shop.
This has to be this doesn't have to be something very major. Rather,
no.
The child has to see it as something important that's been given to him.
Exactly.
Right?
The child needs to see something important, needs to see something that is actually valuable for the parent, basically. It's not something that the parent doesn't care about. It's something the parent cares about it. Whether it's buying something, for example, it's related to money, it's related to something that's valuable, it's related to a person, for example. When a child is given these tasks, and obviously it's a task that a parent can actually expect a successful result out of this. Not that you...
Overburdening the child.
Yeah, we don't want to overburden the child or give a child a task that definitely will just fail. No. Make sure you give a child a task, a responsibility that the child would actually be successful in that. And when that happens, the child fulfills and sees results from their work, results from the responsibility that they've taken. This, again, is another form of strengthening their confidence. Basically, when we see result of our actions, this is crucial in really strengthening this confidence and being able to do things even greater and be having this ambition to aim higher and higher, basically. And so as much as we can as parents, we need to highlight those results. And I think it's something we talked about when we talked about praising a child as well. It's very important to always highlight those results that a child has produced. You don't even need to say, oh, you're an amazing builder or you're amazing this and that. You need to say, for example, this thing that you built is very strong. And what happens is that a child realizes that my actions has a very valuable result. Basically.
He'll relate that to himself automatically. You don't have to point that out.
Yeah.
So we'll carry on from where you left in the next program, if it's okay with you. We spoke about responsibility, value, and respect given to the child and how it affects his confidence. Dear listeners, if you've got any questions, send it to us on our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Do visit our website if you've missed out on our previous programs, parstoday.com. That's parstoday.com. Until next time, please wait for us for the next program. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone.